Great. Well, let me just give you a short introduction and you may begin.
Okay.
So, everyone, this is Helga Zepp LaRouche.
Okay, so when we decided to have this conference in Los Angeles, the purpose was to focus on what has to be the way out of this quickly accelerating global financial and strategic crisis, with the specific focus on the Pacific perspective. The reason why this is because the transatlantic region of the world right now is in a terrible crisis, which I will go into in a moment. And, you know, as you will hear at later parts of this conference, we will discuss the world land bridge, the new economic platform, which would be created through a gigantic qualitative increase in energy flux density, which would be accomplished through the accomplishment of fusion power. But there is actually something has happened this past week which dramatically, dramatically emphasizes why we have to completely change the present paradigm. On Monday this past week, something quite extraordinary has occurred, namely that in almost all leading Chinese media, there were articles and detailed maps with pictures, photographs, and graphics showing the ability of the Chinese Navy, especially their strategic submarine force, to attack the west coast of the United States. And the message given in these articles and pictures is very clear, that China is ready, that if there would be an attack by the West, by the United States and NATO on China, then this will happen. And then they show that the strategic submarines of China could reach, with nuclear missiles, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle. And they also have accompanying maps which show that the radioactive fallout would basically destroy the entire West Coast into the Midwest, into Chicago. And then they also say that they have about 7,500 ICBMs, which could be sent via the North Pole and reach most population centers in the East Coast. Now, this is not a threat by China, but this is clearly a reaction to what is perceived as an absolute immediate potential danger to the mainland of China coming from the United States and Great Britain, but also NATO and the whole global deployment which targets right now Russia and China. Now, most people and this was published then, I think, on Thursday in the Washington Press with a detailed map showing these deployments. I don't know if you can see this, but I want to give you a picture of how that looks. Here in the West, you have the fallout curve coming from such an attack on the West Coast of the United States. Now, the message, therefore, is quite clear that China is ready, that they have a strategic force and a second strike capability in case of an attack on China itself. Now, this does not come as a surprise to anybody who has been watching the developments, because earlier this year, there was a quite shocking article in the official journal of the U.S. Air Force, which said that because of the development of nuclear weapons and especially the targeting and acquisition capabilities that it would be now possible to attack the nuclear arsenal of any enemy without causing a nuclear fallout, and that therefore the old NATO strategy of mutual assured destruction, whereby the word was that if any side uses nuclear weapons, it will lead to the total annihilation of the entire human population, and therefore the use of these weapons is impossible, that doctrine no longer exists because you have these technological advancements, and therefore to take out the nuclear arsenal of an opponent is now feasible. Now, shortly, a couple of months later, Professor Etzioni had an article in the official strategic review of Yale University where he wrote with the headline, "Who authorized the preparation for a war with China?" Where he says that presently the US military is geared towards a coming war with China, and the facts in the article are all correct, except that he blames the leadership of the Pentagon of having designed such a strategy. And basically then he says this needs now an urgent discussion in the Congress by the White House and among thinking individuals about what are the consequences of such a policy. Now, obviously, given the fact that the present Pentagon has been the key force trying to prevent an escalation, like in the recent example in Syria, the blame on the Pentagon is misleading. But obviously, that is presently the U.S. Policy. Now, this trajectory of a confrontation, including that of nuclear weapons, has been going on for quite some time. My husband, Mr. LaRouche, who will speak to you shortly, points to the fact that this direction has been chosen since and with the assassination of President Kennedy. And it was only very briefly interrupted when, in the beginning of the 80s, it was very clear that this already was bringing up the immediate danger of World War III, because the medium-range missiles of both NATO and the Warsaw Pact were in short distance to each other. The Pershing 2 and the SS-20 were facing each other in Central Europe with only a few minutes warning time. And because of such short warning time, these missiles at that time were on launch on warning, which meant that if one superpower would launch a missile or would have the perception that the other one would have launched it, they would have to basically send the entire arsenal because the warning time was too short. So this was the hair trigger annihilation danger, which was the context for Lyndon LaRouche to develop the SDI, or what became the SDI policy, which was then in March 83 adopted by President Reagan, and which was on the table for a couple of months as a real war avoidance option. But then it was rejected first by the Soviet government, but also by the Bush-Kissinger faction in the Reagan administration. So that chance was thrown out of the window. And then, naturally, when the Soviet Union collapsed between 89 and 91, there was the real possibility for a peace order, because at that point, no enemy existed any longer. Communism was defeated. But at that point, unfortunately, the British, in the form of Margaret Thatcher, and the United States, through the person of Bush Sr. and the neocons, they decided to use the collapse of the Soviet Union to build a global empire based on the Anglo-American special relationship. And that is when the present trajectory towards this war danger was accelerated. What you saw in Europe was the NATO expansion eastward, together with the EU expansion, which Russia correctly judged as an encirclement of Russia. To this belongs, for example, the establishment of a U.S. Defense missile system in Poland and Czechia, which Russia has warned against. They will not allow the completion in the last phase four, because that would then take out the second strike capability of Russia in case of an attack. And they said they will not allow it. But then you have to see all the other steps of such a global policy. Like, for example, you have the air sea battle, or what Obama calls the Asia pivot policy, which is an encirclement of China. And if Australian politicians are quite open to say that Australia or certain people in the Australian government see a coming war with China as inevitable, and that others are criticizing that the entire continent of Australia has become nothing but an airbase of the United States for such a war, then you see that the present reaction of China to all of these deployments is just a reaction, because both Russia and China do feel encircled, and they are. I mean, even honest military from Europe or the United States admit that. So if you look at that immediate danger and the fact that we are sitting on an absolute volcano in terms of the immediate danger of a blowout of the financial system of the transatlantic region, which naturally is not limited to Europe and the United States, given the role of the dollar in the world. So then basically you can actually see what is going on. Now, I should note that what we have right now is the point which Lyndon LaRouche predicted would happen after Nixon decoupled the dollar from gold on the 15th of August 1971, where the fixed exchange rates were abandoned, where the old Bretton Woods system was eliminated through Nixon. And Lynn at that time said, if we stay on this course, then we inevitably will go to a new depression and the danger of a new fascism. And that is exactly where we are today, because only the blind can deny the fact that we are confronted with the danger of a fascist dictatorship in Europe and in the United States. In Europe, it is very clear that that process, which started with the introduction of the euro, the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, Maastricht, which was, you know, the imposition of the European currency union. No people of Europe was asked if they liked that, but it was meant to transform the EU into the regional expression of this Anglo-American dominated empire, which basically, if you replace the word globalization for the totality of the central banks, the investment banks, the hedge funds, the private equity funds, the insurance companies, that which you can call the financial oligarchy today, then you can actually see that that oligarchy being confronted with their demise, because we are sitting on a volcano which could explode any moment, whereby the collapse of the Lehman Brothers in 2008 would just be the proverbial peanuts. And right now you have both the financial institutions of Europe and of the United States preparing high gear to somehow unload the cost of this present situation on the population. Now, the paradigm shift, which was introduced in 71 by Nixon to accelerate the shift away from speculation, away from production to speculation, was accelerated with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where globalization deregulated the markets completely by only having the idea of money makes money completely disemphasizing production and the real economy. And now this situation has reached a point where this system is so indebted, and that after the 2008 crisis and the process of bail-ins, private gambling debt was completely transformed into public state debt. Now, all the top bankers, the too big to fail, know that their system is to blow. And they are preparing high gear to have a set of the following set of measures. They want to continue quantitative easing, printing money, which is threatening in the short term a blowout of the hyperinflationary blowout of the system, which you already can see in the form of high prices in food, in energy, in gasoline, and you know the real inflation for the general population, which is not belonging to the super rich, is already between 20% and 30%. That bailout continuation and quantitative easing, however, should be combined with a bail-in. Now, that is the Cyprus model, and that if that is applied for all of Europe and the United States, which is what are the laws written already, then you would have the Cyprus model or the Detroit model applied to all of Europe and all of the United States. Now, this is shortly about to happen. For example, Münchau, a columnist in the Financial Times and Spiegel Online, had an article last week where he said the SPD in Germany, which is in coalition discussions with the CDU to form a new government, they should not take the finance ministry because they should be happy not to take the blame for the coming blowout which will occur. Either way, either you will have a bail-in, a haircut, and you know then you have the Cyprus model applied on all of Europe, or the Eurozone will collapse and you have a disintegration that way. Now, the oligarchy, which is in personnel in large part identical with the too-big-to-fail banks. For example, if you look at the CEOs of the hedge funds, who have 80% of them their headquarters in London, many of them are high nobility. So you cannot separate the British Empire monarchical system from the financial oligarchy, and that oligarchy is absolutely determined to turn the clock back. They want to go back to feudalism. They want to have an elimination of republicanism. They want to have no nation state. They want to have cities and regions and backward population. But most of all, they want to reduce the present world population from 7 billion to somewhere around 1 billion or less. Now, this is well documented. This is absolutely not debatable. But then you look at the present medicines which are applied to the crisis in the United States and in Europe, and you see that the economic policies prescribed are genocide. What the Troika has been doing in Greece is genocide. They have increased the death rate. They have increased the suicide rates. They have shortened the life expectancy. And the same has been happening in Cyprus, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal. And if the bail-in would be implemented, it would apply in all of Europe. And that is what is happening in the United States. Obamacare is not what some foolish Western medias in Europe are still peddling. It is not meant to provide every American with medical care, but it is eliminating entire categories of people to be treated, of patients to be treated, sicknesses which are no longer covered by the policies of the health insurance. And as it now turns out, that already in 2010, the administration knew that 93 million people would be thrown out of the health insurance through Obamacare. Now, if you combine that with the increase of poverty in the United States, 48 million Americans are living on food stamps. I mean, that is a large number of people. That is almost more than half of entire German population. And now, with the new cuts, 5 billion are supposed to be cut from the food stamps for these 48 million people, which means that, you know, for all affected, the food stamps of 1 week per month will go, and many people will not make it. So what we are looking at is an unbelievable world crisis. So therefore, I think we need to absolutely accelerate our efforts to wake the population up about these twofold dangers, the danger of an immediate thermonuclear war and the danger of a fascist dictatorship implementing fascist economic policies, which will not work on top of it. And we have to fight to get the alternative on the table. Now, the good thing is there is an absolute alternative in place. The alternative would be that we immediately implement Glass-Steagall. As you know, we have a growing movement for Glass-Steagall in the United States. We have a massive discussion in Europe about Glass-Steagall. In the Italian parliament, we have 5 bills introduced. We have about 500 mayors in France. We have an increasing number of mayors and city councils in Germany who are fighting for Glass-Steagall. Now, if the United States would implement Glass-Steagall, Europe would have no other chance than to follow immediately. But we need a global Glass-Steagall, because Glass-Steagall is only the first step. The next thing is we need to go to a credit system in the tradition of Alexander Hamilton's National Bank. That means we have to, in Europe, to go back to sovereign control over the national currencies, get rid of the euro, which is a failed experiment, and then have in each nation, in Asia, in Europe, in the United States, in Africa, Latin America, national banks, which together agree on a whole set of international projects, which would be around the World Land Bridge, Navapa, the Bering Strait Tunnel, the Kra Canal, the Eurasian Land Bridge, large water projects for Africa, a water and desalinization project for the Middle East, and many other projects which we will talk about in the course of this conference. But it would immediately set up a network of credit agreements, long-term credit agreements, based on the national banking system of each sovereign countries to jointly finance these long-term projects, which would have a duration of 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And we could get out of this crisis immediately. Now, we have been fighting for this since 1989. When the wall came down, we proposed the productive triangle for Europe first. Then when the Soviet Union collapsed, we expanded that to the Eurasian land bridge. And in the meantime, with some ups and downs, now the Chinese President Xi Jinping has proposed the new Silk Road to be the Chinese policy for the building of the new Silk Road throughout Central Asia and beyond. He has called for the maritime Silk Road together with Indonesia, and many, many other countries are ready to cooperate in such a proposal. But it needs to be boldly put on the table, and it can only succeed if we mobilize the population, at least the moral people, the 5% thinking people, the people who regard themselves as world historical individuals in this absolute incredible moment of crisis of civilization. But I'm absolutely certain that this effort will only succeed if we get rid of the culture of globalization. Because globalization is not only a system which throws people into slavery and kills people, but it is a system which goes along with a culture or counterculture, which is exactly in the footsteps of the Roman Empire, where the Neros were and the Caesars were using the bread and circus to dumb the population, to turn them into bestial people participating in the crime committed in the circus. And that is exactly what the global culture is. If you look at the so-called pop culture, if you look at the Madonnas and Lady Gagas of the world, you see that it is completely satanic. It is pornographic, it is bestial, it has an image of man as an absolute depraved creature. And if we do not reject that kind of image of man, which is also expressed in the video games, in most of the popular entertainment, then I don't think we can mobilize the moral integrity to effect the necessary change to save civilization. And therefore, we absolutely have to have a renaissance of classical culture, of classical music, and of classical poetry in the best forms expressed by the Greek tragedians, by Shakespeare, by Schiller, by Shelley, Keats, and such people. Because we have to uplift ourselves and reject everything which has to do with pleasure in the here and now, based on these depraved cultural entertainments. And we have to make the next paradigm shift into a new paradigm, a new renaissance of civilization, whereby man is true to his identity as a creative human being. And the only way how we can nourish that is by studying and enjoying the great classical compositions, especially in music, but also in poetry, drama, architecture, painting. But obviously, classical music is the international language which goes directly to the soul of the people. Now, I do not know if we can save civilization. I must say, having been in politics together with Lynn for the last 40 years, I must really say that the civilization hangs by a thread. The danger that we may not exist as a civilization, and that all the beautiful works of art, all the struggles of so many noble individuals were all in vain, and that mankind will annihilate itself because we were not capable to get rid of this bestial oligarchy which has mankind in its grip right now. That chance is unfortunately extremely big. So therefore, let's really go into this conference with the solemn commitment and beyond that we will mobilize the American population to say no to these policies, to affect the kinds of changes in the Congress, because the Congress is the one place which could affect, the necessary adjustments, concerning the government, concerning defending the Constitution, of upholding the beautiful idea of the American Revolution and the paradigm which goes with that. But at this point, it really requires a miracle. So since I believe in miracles, but only those which we do ourselves, let's become the kind of warrior angels which is needed to cause this change.
So I think what we'll try to do is, Helga, we'll take a couple of questions for you now, and then we'll have Lynn, and we can take questions for them, both of you. Does that work for you?
That's fine.
Okay, great. So are there a couple of questions? So if you come up to the mic here and speak, so that way she can hear you and see you. I'll take one more question. If there's a couple, we'll take them, and then we'll move on to Lynn.
Hi, my name is Sean. I'm the founder president of the Evergreen Award, licensee for evacuative transport, ED3. Also, I'm a founder member of the President Obama's Organizing for Action and climate leader at Vice President Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. First of all, I thank Lena Platt for inviting me to this conference, and I have discussed many things and exchanged views with her related to the theme of this conference by telephone before coming here. Based on my discussion with her, I would like to raise the following questions with regard to the U.S. policies of fiscal, monetary, trade, and foreign, since U.S. economy is the key to the global economy. Overall, the U.S. global trade is deficit. Its trade with the top 16 Asian Pacific countries is to a deficit balance of $3,234 billion from 2001 to 2010, as per the information of U.S. Department of Commerce. The countries are South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Australia, Malaysia, India, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, New Zealand, Pakistan, Vietnam, Japan, China, and Bangladesh. Based on the information, there are many questions arise. Why the U.S. have not taken any serious action all these years to improve its trade deficit? Is it because it doesn't care the deficit trade balance, since it has the power to print unlimited money, where the U.S. has been accepted, dollar has been accepted worldwide as the single global trade currency? Why U.S. doesn't promote its trade through its diplomatic missions around the world, like other countries such as China, Australia, New Zealand, and Sri Lanka, where they often organize trade fairs, wine tastings, tea tastings, etc.? Why USA concentrates more on internal politics rather than concentrating with bilateral relationship? Two, in 2008, some of the banks were bailed out by the U.S. federal government, where they were in the verge of bankruptcy due to mortgage crisis. As for the Federal Reserve Bank's bulletin, loan loss reserves and unearned income, the past due is $158 billion, and the bailed out amount was $204.8 billion. Household loss to this crisis were 1.2 million. Actually, the federal government has bailed out those banks on behalf of the defaulted mortgage owners for their defaulted payments. The banks should have handed over their houses back to them upon the bailout. But the banks were tricky and unfair on that occasion, where they have cheated the federal government as well as their government customers and made double money or profit without handing over their houses back. As for the reliable information, the mortgage owners who have been paid over a period of 5 years also been... just 2 minutes, okay, yes. Okay. Based on this information, again, there are many questions arise. What is the U.S. Federal Bank's role over the banks and financial institutions? Does the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank supervise the activities of the banks and financial institutions regularly? Why the Congress and Senate couldn't analyze the impact before passing the bill? Who is responsible for 1.2 million people who went to the street by losing their homes under this trick? Further, the U.S. GDP is approximately $15 trillion, and the public debt is approximately $16 billion, and it's marketable. This is the question I'm asking. This is the policy. What I'm saying, we need policies. Yes. So it's my opinion that there should be a change in U.S. policies on monetary, fiscal, foreign, in order to have a balanced approach to strengthen its economy. Otherwise, it will have a big negative impact in the future, since BRICS countries are strategically moving forward against the weakened U.S. monetary, fiscal, and foreign policies.
Yes, I think the only way one can understand this behavior, which obviously is violating U.S. interest. I mean, why is the United States pursuing an economic and financial policy which is clearly against the interest of the U.S. itself, of the U.S. population, as much as it is against the interest of these countries you named? And the only way to understand it is that the present dominant policy of the U.S. and the Anglo-Dutch Empire is globalization. That is, you cannot understand it from the standpoint of a nation interest, national interest of the United States, but that the present too-big-to-fail banks, the 28 or so too-big-to-fail banks internationally, constitute a financial oligarchy which believes that their richness does not come from production in the real economy, but it comes from controlling and manipulating the global financial markets. Now, you have seen that in the form of the LIBOR manipulation, where the 28 or 24 largest banks in the world for 2 decades or more manipulated the foreign exchange rates, cheating their customers by 3-digit billion amounts. You know, if you control the international markets, you can make an enormous amount of money by playing the markets, by manipulating the markets, while production is collapsing. And they intend to keep that system. They want to keep the system of derivatives, of creative financial instruments, because, as you can see, even after the collapse of 2008 and the continuation of the bailout policies, the number of millionaires and billionaires in the transatlantic region has become larger. There are more millionaires and more billionaires, but there are also a lot more poor people in every country, in Europe, in the United States, in Brazil, in Africa. The gap between rich and poor as a result of this policy has absolutely increased. So the only answer how to remedy that is that the United States must become back a nation and not adopt the British Empire doctrine as the platform for their policy. The battle in the United States right now is between running the world as an empire based on the Anglo-American special relationship, a policy which repeatedly was introduced in America, starting probably with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. But America must go back to the idea of the American Revolution, the American Republic, the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and above all, the foreign policy approach of John Quincy Adams, who believed that the world can only be peaceful if there is an alliance of perfectly sovereign nation states working together for the common aim of mankind. Now, the kind of policy what we are proposing with NAWAPA, which would be the largest water management project ever in the tradition of the TVA of Roosevelt, immediately you would create 6 million productive jobs. You would basically then have a motor to gear up the U.S. economy domestically by bringing the idle water from Alaska and Canada along the Rocky Mountains all the way to Mexico, to in the desert states along the Rocky Mountains. And you would start to build up the domestic market in the United States. Now, the danger right now is, unlike in the Depression and the big crisis of the 30s, that because of the globalization and the outsourcing of a lot of production by turning a lot of countries of Asia into cheap labor markets for the U.S. domestic markets, that a lot of the productive capacities which existed in the time of the 30s no longer exist. There are not so many family farmers as were in the 30s. There are not so many Mittelstand, middle-level industries, because a lot of industrial production has been outsourced. So therefore, a large project like NAWAPA and affiliated projects is absolutely crucial for the survival of the United States. Now, obviously, you know, we need to build up the domestic economies of every single nation state around the world. And then, you know, if you go from the assumption that the only source of wealth is not the manipulation of free trade or the prices market structure of the global markets, but that the only source of wealth is the creative power of the own citizens. Therefore, any country which is concerned about the well-being of its citizens and its economy must think to upgrade the education level, to upgrade the creative powers of their own workforce, and that can only be accomplished through science driver programs like you know, what we are proposing now with the increase in the energy flux density in the realm of a crash program for fusion power. That same problem of upgrading the population, of making them more productive by increasing their creative powers, that is a problem which poses itself for every single nation on this planet. For the United States, emphatically, because the education level has been collapsed since decades. It is an absolute urgency for China. If China wants to develop the interior regions, it must absolutely transform a rural population into an educated labor force. Naturally, the same problem exists in Latin America, in Africa, and even in countries like Germany, because of the green paradigm, the cognitive power of the population has been almost devastated. A greenie is a stupid person because they believe in a cultish idea of a world which does not exist. What we have to do is we have to bring the production and the politics into cohesion with the laws of the universe. And the laws of the universe are not entropic. They are definitely anti-entropic. And human creativity is what corresponds to the laws of the universe. And we have reached a point in human civilization where either we bring our policy, our economic policy, our social policy into cohesion with the laws of the physical universe, or we will not make it. So I think that right now the answer is, you know, we have to build up the productive powers of the United States, and that way, you know, the trade deficit would quickly vanish, because then you can organize both your domestic affairs and the relation among countries in a rational form and actually, you know, be human.
Thank you very much. So before I take the next question, let me just say, when a person is asking a question, we very much appreciate your question and participation. We don't need any comments from the audience. We will be moderating. We do want substantial discussions and questions, but obviously time is limited, especially with Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche. So if you can, you know, make your question as succinct as possible, but we appreciate the participation, absolutely. So let me take one more question from Mrs. LaRouche. Please come up and introduce yourself.
The name is Eric Levitt, and I'm a book author. Mrs. LaRouche, I can't thank you enough for noting the culture war against our civilization, which really kicked in gear in the 60s and devastated that decade. As a lifelong musician, and more recently a screenwriter, may we add classic film to your list of classical music, classical literature, classical poetry? We know that reforming Hollywood is hopeless, and but happy to say, and I'll leave this to you, happy to say that I am working with a number of people to change not Hollywood, but the direction of the film and entertainment industry. So may we include classic films on your list, and I believe that will really help further change our culture.
I can fully agree with you, because you know, classical drama, for example, historical dramas, have the same function like a good classical movie. Because, you know, when Schiller wrote his treatise about theater as a moral institution, he said that in that sense, you know, the film is just a way of making the stage of the theater more easy to be communicated to larger numbers of people, while it is naturally a different form of medium, and if it's good, a different form of art. Nevertheless, it addresses potentially the same thing, namely it can strengthen the power of imagination. And, you know, given the fact that most people cannot imagine the future, most people have absolutely no way of even knowing if, you know, when you see a train running, crashing against the wall, which is what the present strategic situation is, most people say, I cannot believe you, this has not happened yet. These people up there, the powers to be, they will never let it happen. And, you know, it has to do with the fact that people are believing in their sensuous experience and experience of the past. They cannot imagine, neither in the negative way, what is the outcome of the present policies, nor can they imagine what would be a vision of mankind for the future, which would be in cohesion with the dignity of man. Now, great classical drama and poetry, but especially drama, and potentially naturally good films, would inspire people to imagine to imagine scenarios, to imagine the large issues of mankind, as Schiller would use to call it. Something, you know, you have a normal salesperson or a barber or an engineer, and they're doing their job, but they have not the time because they have to take care of their livelihood every day. They have not the time to think about a vision, how should mankind look in 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now. And it is the work of the poets, the film writers, the artists, the drama writers, to have the kind of vision which ennobles man, which enriches his imagination power, because it is that imagination power to think in hypothesis, to think something which has never been thought before, something which is a new idea, a new necessary idea for mankind to go to, but it requires that kind of inspiration. Now, I think that great film would have a wonderful work because in the time of, you know, modern communication, you could reach every village, every part of the world, which is now affected with... I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That happens. So I'm sorry. Here I was reminded of globalization. no, but you know what is now you know polluting. You have TV sets in villages in Africa where people have nothing to eat, but they have a disgusting video set. With disgusting movies in it, you could transform the same thing for a good purpose. You could do so much with modern means. And you know, I mean, classical film was once an art. And I can say that in my view, since the 50s, there are a few exceptions, but they are mostly, you know, in somewhere in film festivals, which are way off from the mainstream. There are some decent films even nowadays. But if you think back, films used to have a plot, which was, you know, like a plot which would develop and almost be like a musical composition where there would be a thorough composition, a lot of tension, a lot of resolution, a lot of lawful punctum salience development in the film. And then the film would come to a surprising or satisfying end. And the person who has watched that movie would go and be elevated and inspired even for hours or days after seeing the movie. Now, that has completely disappeared. You have soap operas which go on and on forever for decades. And, you know, there is no rhyme and no rhythm. It just keeps going and it dulls people. And it makes people addictive because they almost live more in these soap operas than in the real world. And that has a method. So I welcome your initiative, and I think this is absolutely crucial because we need creative people to participate in all possible fields to get the poor civilization from its present course. So I will in the future include classical film absolutely in the list of my proposals, and I'm looking forward to hear more from you.
Thank you very much.
So we will have more time for more questions with Mrs. LaRouche. But I think given just the time restraints on both of their participation,
yeah,
I'd like to, if possible, then introduce now Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. Many people here are familiar with him and his wife's work. They both have been working together now for over 40 years on the question of human development. And so I'm sure everyone will hear what he has to say.
Hold on for just a moment.
That'd be wired for sound. I hope the wire is sound.
Hold on. Okay. There we go.
All right. Well, Helga's covered a lot of territory right now. And it's impressive to me because it takes the burden off me, so that, as you can imagine, for example. There are several problems which are specific to the present situation. One is obviously a strategic situation, which Helga has touched upon in various aspects. There's also the question of what is the alternative to the collapse of civilization, which is now ongoing. I'm speaking specifically of the economy of the United States, the economy of Europe, and to a large degree the transatlantic region. Now, what's happened in the transatlantic region, which had been, in a former period of time, the great driver of progress, the United States, especially the United States at its peak as an economy, see, but since the time of some of our greatest leaders, we have been sinking down. We've been in a state of decline permanently from the time of the death of John F. Kennedy until the present time. That is, the death and the assassination of John F. Kennedy marked the beginning of a great collapse in the United States, of the economy, and of the morality of our people. The same thing happened somewhat in Europe, Western and Central Europe, the same kind of thing. Now, what we have, therefore, is a question, given the degree of collapse of the economy, of the industries, of the ability to produce, in the United States in particular, as in Western and Central Europe, we've reached a point where this system, in its present form, cannot survive. We've reached a breakdown point in the system. The question is, how can we launch a recovery of the United States immediately, but also the transatlantic region and the world as a whole? How can we do that? Well, you look at, there's some good points in Asia which are very important. Such as in China. China has a great potential now if it is encouraged and enabled to do that. Other nations in the Pacific region, some of them at least, also have a similar contribution to make. They are still on the upgrade, still making progress. China is most notable in this case. And it, of course, has been accelerated by the question of the military defense of China, which is threatened not by anybody else, but by the British system, Anglo-Dutch system, and by some degrees in the United States itself. So therefore, is it possible, given the fact that the trend of collapse in the United States, across the Atlantic, into Europe, is it possible that these nations can recover from the collapse which is fully underway now? And that's the challenge. And what I want to focus on is essentially an approach to dealing with this crisis. There is no chance of a spontaneous recovery of the U.S. economy at this time. There would have to be the elimination of this current president of the United States, as of the Bush family representatives earlier. From the time of young Bush entering office, the United States has been in an accelerating rate of general collapse. We no longer have significant industry. We have some local industries which are leftovers of a general wreckage. We are now at a point, as of this week, that a factor of active genocide has been introduced to the victims in the U.S. population. this is the new law put through in sponsorship of the current president. As long as that policy exists, the situation of the United States would be hopeless. That is of the people of the United States. The hyperinflation is only a factor in this thing. So therefore, the question is, where can the recovery of economy and nations occur? My suggestion is there are some indications of ways in which we could integrate the recovery of nations such as the United States together with the Pacific region, because the Pacific region has not collapsed in the degree that the United States economy has collapsed, or the American economy of the Americans, for example. So therefore, that's interesting. We also have India is in a better state of affairs than the United States, too. We have other nations, groups of nations, which have significant potential for some greater or lesser degree of recovery. Now, despite those limitations, there are two basic opportunities to stand before us now. One is what's called NWAPA. That's the great water project, which is the greatest project which stands before us now inside the economy of the United States and also Canada. That would be positive, but it's not being done. We've also had technologies which we have proposed. They have not been done. This is under Bush and under NWAPA. The United States is literally going to hell on this case. So therefore, what's the solution? How do we, apart from moving Obama out of the presidency, which would be a great boon to the world and the United States in particular, what are the means that we could use now, which would be a starting point of reference for a general recovery of civilization on the planet? One thing, of course, is a proper view of Mars, of space exploration, of defense of space against large rocks, which we can, if they, in some cases, if they were hit Earth, one of these would actually terminate the existence of the human species on Earth. So therefore, these kinds of problems and similar kinds of problems are correlatives which indicate that there's something we have to do to defend the very existence of the people of the United States and of the world, and so forth. There also, the Mars thing has a very significant importance in this process. But the main thing here is, what's the immediate action? Well, since the beginning of the 1970s, we had the achievement of a provable case for thermonuclear fusion. This was done by, I was part of one of these teams involved in this thing during that time. But this thing was put under wraps. It was crushed. It was held back. We have never really done either what was called NWAPA, the Great North American Water Power System. That's a great, which can still be done and must be done. We also have other problems of the same kind. But the main one is also the fact that China in particular and adjoining nations in Asia have not collapsed during the period that the European system has collapsed, the U.S. economy has collapsed, the South American economies are disintegrating, more or less. The tragedy of Africa, which is still a great tragedy, says, where can we go? What can we touch which would save the future of mankind? Well, already recently, we've had a collapse of income decreed by Obama. Obama is program, if implemented, and it is being implemented, prescribes genocidal collapse of large sections of the U.S. population. That's already in place under Obama. Now, if we were to be fortunate enough to remove Obama from office, then we have a number of options. There are things we can start and do, which would be very useful, but we have virtually no significant depth of industry and no significant depth of agriculture. We are not producing and cannot presently produce a sufficient amount of agricultural product to maintain the population of the people of the United States. These are the kinds of problems that must be faced now. Obama must be removed from office. Without his being removed from office, there's no hope for anything but a Holocaust of one degree or another for the U.S. population. Well, let's suppose Obama is removed judiciously and for judicious reasons. Then we have a blank slate because we don't have industry of any significance anymore. All our great industries have been collapsed, disbanded. Our people have not only have been unemployed, but more and more of them have lost the ability to produce. Their brains, their so forth, are not developed as they should have been. They've been crushed. And this last bill that was rammed through by Obama is the signal of an action which will cause an acceleration of the death rate in the U.S. population. So what's the solution? Well, I say get rid of Obama. Have him impeached, as he should be. Then we do have a possible option. Now, one of the options is, as I've mentioned, is NOAPA. But NOAPA could not be implemented under the present economic circumstances inside the United States. It could be implemented in design. There are still a few aging people who know how to do what has to be done to install NOAPA. But there are not many of them, and those who exist have no significant opportunity to do anything for NOAPA. So the United States is now dying. It's a dying economy. And there will be soon, if we don't stop this, mass death to follow. All right. What could break this? Well, we have one technology which I became familiar with back in the early 1970s. And that is the development of thermonuclear fusion. Now, thermonuclear fusion has been on the table since the early part of the 1970s, but has not been implemented except in very limited token ways. And more, there's an absolute systemic suppression of clear understanding of what that would mean. But going to this higher level of intensity, of energy flux density, which that represents, which is the greatest leap available to us for all mankind. But since the early 1970s, there has been a ban on any significant application of that kind of thermonuclear fusion. There have been some small token things which do not rise to the level of having the significance of a driver for the world economy. China, however, is not bankrupt. China is not in great shape relative to what we used to set as standards of progress, but China has a vitality with limitations, admittedly. We have also other parts of Asia which is a part of the Asian or Trans-Pacific region, do have some capability for rising to the challenge of thermonuclear fusion. And only thermonuclear fusion is an adequate instrument for rescuing the world and the world's population from the present crisis. So that now we will not be able to achieve, in my best estimate, a full-throated thermonuclear fusion in less than a decade. It would take a decade or more. We used to talk about 30 years to realize thermonuclear fusion. Today, I believe we could do better. We could do better by cooperation among a great number of nations, doing experimental work to go into the phase of operation of thermonuclear fusion. That would enable us to begin to halt the rate of collapse inside the world economy generally, and to restore some degree of actual significant progress. The first objective has to be to hold the line, to stop the flow into disaster. And whatever we can do in that direction, whatever means we can... it should be done. It should be done immediately. Because the first thing is we have to realize we have entire populations in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere who are totally incompetent in respect of these kinds of economies, even simpler forms of economy. And that's where we stand right now. That's my key issue. The increase of the energy flux density, as expressed in terms of thermonuclear fusion, applied to all applications of industry and environment and so forth, is the essential only solution for pulling the world as a whole, the world as a whole, especially the transatlantic region, to saving those nations. Frankly, you cannot save those nations without such measures. Even though it may take 10 years or more to get thermonuclear fusion actually operating on the level necessary, even experimentally, nonetheless, the fact that we are committed to developing that technology means that we have an active chance. We can take areas like China, which still has the facility to make progress in that direction. Some other nations of Asia also have that. India has a certain degree of obvious capability. But the problem is the collapse of the transatlantic region is one of the greatest catastrophes. But why did it happen? It happened because forces that feared the United States and feared more than that what the United States had represented at its best, the destruction of that intellectual capability, the demoralization of the citizens of the United States, has brought us to the point that we are headed toward a general breakdown crisis. And what was started this week in terms of the Obama program for gradual genocide against the poor people of the United States is a warning sign. Take into account the fact that the food supply, the generation of food supply of the U.S. population is now on the negative side and getting worse rapidly. So this is the what faces us most essentially. So NUAPA is key. Thermonuclear fusion, as I've indicated, is key. Now, what my approach is specifically this. I've proposed with my associates and others that we recognize that the region of the United States to the west of the Mississippi River is one of the great catastrophic areas. That's where some of the worst collapse is occurring. That's where a great deal of our food supply is disappearing. And you know some of the things in California also, similar types of collapse in this region, which had once had a great prosperity. The southern part of California had a great prosperity, despite all the faults in the system. And now it's tragic. So therefore, the only chance is to get us started in the direction of restoring a commitment to progress, energy flux density in progress. And I know we can do that. The question is, where's the will to back up the realization? The problem had been that the United States and Western Europe were particular targets for destruction of the capability of productivity during this whole period. It started essentially with, you know, George W. Bush Jr., who is one of our great catastrophes. Obama is the worst catastrophe ever to hit the United States. As we keep Obama in office, we're dead. The United States is dead. So this man must be impeached. Glass-Steagall must be reestablished. And we must have applied energy flux density programs for building up food supply, for rebuilding up production, for initiating production where it no longer exists, and defending our population's lives against the terrible conditions which have been put upon us successively by George W. Bush Jr. and by Obama. These are the two curses. If we have that kind of program we need and start it, we can win. We can survive. But we have to recognize that since the death of John F. Kennedy as president, the United States economy has been in a successively stage of decline, collapse. Don't kid yourself. This economy has collapsed since that time. It's at different rates at different times. But now it's full. The United States is doomed unless we find a change in direction of our economy. And the best thing is to tie ourselves closely into sections of Asia which may, where they may not be perfect by our old standards, they are necessary as a part of finding the resources to begin to rebuild our economy and put our people back to work, get back into production. And the first thing to do is shut down Wall Street and shut down everything that represents that. Because as long as Wall Street is bleeding the economies of the United States itself is doomed. A way to do that? Glass-Steagall. Put Glass-Steagall into power immediately, and the turret tide can be turned. It will not be turned automatically, but it can be returned if we do that. That's where we stand. And since Helga's covered a lot of area, I'll now pass it back to you.
Thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Helga. So, Lynn, I think we have a few minutes for questions. So if a few people could come up, Gene. We'll take Gene first, and then we'll take you. Good. And you can go third. And we'll see. Please keep your questions succinct, and go ahead.
Hello, Mr. LaRouche.
Yes.
My name is Gene Essig. I live in Yucca Valley, California. This is not a question. It is something that I want to tell you. I wanted us to meet today to let you know that I am sending you some on-source data and technology I want to ensure you are aware of. This data actually backs up some of the things you've been saying about our national crises. And when this technology is understood and correctly applied, it is an effective solution to remove Barack Obama from office and thus open the way to pass Glass-Steagall. And you will be receiving this information this week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Robert Newman. I live in Redlands, California. I'm a psychologist by official training. I'm into water and agriculture in California. However, you've spoken a great deal about the economics. You've left out, to a notable extent, the issue of morality and the psyche of human beings, in particular in relation to greed. That's the decay that we've noted rather than commitment to one another. Please address the issue of morality and the issue of greed in human beings. Thank you.
Well, very simply, I have no problem with that, proposition. That's precisely my own. That the issue is the increase of the productive powers of labor and the standard and conditions of life of our citizens. Those are the things that have been destroyed. You want to take also the cultural degeneration of the United States. Since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, there has been a steady decline in the cultural and moral character of the United States population. That doesn't mean in every person, but it means that the trend among persons is that. And in point of fact, it has been since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which was tolerated by leading institutions of the United States, leading political parties and other. It was known what it was. The lid was put on, and the genocide went on. And the United States never recovered from the trend that was set forth by tolerating the assassination of John F. Kennedy, then later his brother as well. That's where the problem lies. And ever since that time, the policies of the United States have been corrupted. So the productive powers of labor have been undermined and destroyed. For example, agriculture, destruction. So I look at these things not the same terms you were talking about, but I look at the terms of morality in the terms of human practice. What is the necessary standard of development of human practice needed for the moral as well as the physical progress of our people? We have been losing that. Look at the children, for example. You have a point. How long does a generation of children live? Well, 20, 25 years. That's what we call children or young adults. And then you look beyond that point. You see, what happened when people reached about the age of 20? And what were they capable of doing? What have they been trained to do? What have they been trained to understand? What is their conception of culture? What the culture should be? What the culture is? And in every regard, the history of the United States, since the assassination of John F. Since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the United States has been decaying culturally and morally. It's as if some great agency in heaven has decreed the United States is not deserving of much toleration. And we certainly have lost a great deal. We have to go back to the kind of standard which actually John F. Kennedy, not as a special person as such, though he was special, he was dedicated to the fulfillment of his association with Eleanor Roosevelt, who had been his campaign manager for that campaign. She had been the inspirer of the drafting of his programs. And if you think of the great things that John F. Kennedy accomplished while he was still permitted to live, and what his brother was able to do while he still lived, and you look at the history of the politicians, you look at the history of the cultural trends, the economic trends, we have been going downhill all the way at varying rates of decline since the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That has never been corrected. Our conditions today are far worse than they ever were then. They've been progressively worse. And that's what the problem is. It's a moral problem. And the moral problem is not expressed in morals as a nominal subject. Moral is practice. Moral is what you do. Moral is what you do for mankind. You know, we are human beings. We're not animals. But often we apply to ourselves a standard of measure for culture as that of animals. Because the human being is different than all other things. Think back. Where did human beings start from? Well, the first knowledge we have of a human being, what it is, we find in the cases in South Africa, where we find some people as survivors or what had been survivors who cooked their food. And that made the difference between them and animals. Mankind cooks his food. Animals do not. They eat what they get. And there, so the culture is based on the fact that how did mankind develop? If you take the handbook of chemistry, just simple, basic, and university handbook of chemistry, how do you measure progress in chemistry? You measure it by going up in the energy flux density of different elements and different compositions that you use. And that's the source. That is done willfully. How is it done? Well, it's done by what's called human creativity. And no animal has human creativity. What does a human being do that an animal can't? The animal discovers a principle of nature, like a physical principle, and uses that principle. Mankind's power and knowledge is increased by the utilization of those principles which are discovered. We're now on the edge of thermonuclear fusion as the active principle of power for the existence of the human species. If we do not develop thermonuclear fusion, as we could, we're not going to survive as a species, or we'll go to some depraved condition. So so morality has to be defined by the distinction of man from beast. It's not that the beasts are inherently bad, they're just not human. And what is human is the power of the human species, like the first man we discovered, who cooked his food, for the evening meal. No animal can do that. And we find that the progress of man to higher and higher layers of fire, of energy flux density, determines the culture of mankind and his progress. And it's our commitment to that culture and commitment to not what we experience as success in our life, but what we make possible for other human beings to succeed in doing when we are gone. We live in the future. We don't live to be buried. We live to be remembered.
Good morning, and it's almost afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche. It was a pleasure seeing you and hearing you today. I always get a lot out of both of you. And I have two very, very broad questions. My background is accounting. I am a retired certified public accountant. I used to specialize in financial statements, taxes, and dabbled in economics, but not obviously as sophisticated as you. My questions are, we have our goals. We know what we want. How do we do them? We want to impeach Obama. We have got to get the strength in the Congress, and I'm not limiting it to Congress because we do have a constitution, and I guess we are a nation of rules and that constitution. How, in that regard, or maybe extra constitutionally, will we be able to implement all our goals or many of our goals that we want to achieve?
I think the goal is essentially progress. Progress of mankind. Look, we have, in the history of mankind, we have all kinds of cultures. We see the degree of suffering that prevails, the ratio of suffering that prevails in those cultures. Our goal is always to improve the future, just like the case of the poor man who cooked his food for the first time in some southern part of Africa. So mankind's ability to realize progress which mankind gives to those who survive him, and those who, in the process of surviving him, create the higher state of living for mankind generally. Our progress, our morality, must be the future of mankind, the future of human progress as a species. We've now reached the point that mankind cannot successfully maintain himself on this planet without thermonuclear fusion as a technology. The problems become too great. Mankind is probably, I tell my people, don't try to start putting man on Mars, but we can put machinery on Mars, equipment on Mars. We can control it by methods which, with suitable technologies, we can actually use Mars as an instrument for defense of Earth. We are now in danger of defense of the entire human population on Earth by certain objects, which if they hit Earth will kill everyone, or if they don't do that, they'll do a lot of damage, great damage as much. So therefore, our human mission, unlike animals, have no true inherent mission. They have things we call a mission, attention. But only mankind can make a discovery, a principle, which is the answer to a fault, a failure in the conditions of life today. And it's the improvement of the conditions of life of mankind and the usefulness of man's progress, which is, for me, everything. Progress, the change from today to tomorrow, the rise from poverty to some degree of success, the rise from ignorance to knowledge, the rise to the joy of realizing that we ourselves as individuals have the ability to make or induce the changes which raise man's condition as such. We should be the servants of our own future and the servants of those who came before us to make that future possible.
So we do have a few more minutes. If there are any other questions for either Mr. or Mrs. LaRouche. Here's your chance. Okay. Come up here and take a seat on the bench, and you can go after him. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche. My name is Damian Baker. I'm a local here in Los Angeles. To add on to the question, and by the way, that response was amazing, and thank you for that. To add on to the response or the question, as an individual, what can an individual do? Implementing a little bit on the answer to the last gentleman's question, what can I do as an individual to join the movement and to actually make a difference?
Well, that's what I do. I do it not for any other reason than the fact that I think it's necessary to make a contribution to the progress of mankind if you're able to discover a means to do so. My motivation is always just simply that. I'm 91 years of age, you know, and so I'm not looking for great futures and great inheritances from anyone to come. I rejoice in the ability to have the freedom and opportunity to make a difference, a difference in the progress of mankind. I've accumulated a lot of knowledge over the experience and in other ways, and I find I can use these experiences, this knowledge, and to do something good, and I enjoy doing something good. I enjoy creating things. I don't like to do a lot of repetitive things unless it's necessary for the creating of things. That's my motive.
Thank you.
Maybe I can add just one thought to this. Mostly people ask, what can I do as an individual? And, you know, I think we have one case where one individual has really caused an earthquake, and that is Edward Snowden. I think for some months people underestimated the effect his revelation and whistleblowing would have. For example, when it became known beginning of June that he was, that the NSA was wiretapping and every communication of all citizens in the United States and also in Europe and many other countries. In Germany, it took really months before people really woke up. But when it became known that the cell phone of Mrs. Merkel was also tapped, you have now an earthquake, which I do not believe will come back into its previous condition of normality. Because, there is right now a bigger rift in the German-American relation than at any time since 1945. And that similar thing is happening with many other countries, which, you know, really shows that if you have an individual who does the right thing at the right time, it can have enormous consequences. And, you know, while obviously he was in a unique position to do something extraordinary, I think if people think about it, you know, we are now in a non-linear development, and we have a short window of opportunity where courageous individuals who have a clear mission sense can do indeed miracles. Because, you know, I mean, for a long time, the Obamacare and similar programs were, people had illusions about it. But now it's coming down like a ton of bricks, the cut in food stamps, the Obamacare eliminating healthcare for so many people, the brutal cuts in many social programs for people who absolutely are depending on it. All of this will hit. And I think what you can do and many others is to help us to reach out to the elected officials on a local level, mayors, city councils, state legislators, other institutions on a local level, so that we really get a mass movement to exert pressure on the Congress, because there is a huge difference between inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway. And I think we have to bring the problems and the absolute urgent life and death concerns from outside the Beltway into Washington so that we get the Congress to act. Congressmen have to be reelected. They are now in their election districts. Go there, raise the issues, and you know, organize just like a firestorm around you, your colleagues, your friends. And I think we can revitalize the United States. I think the United States has proven many, many times that they can come back from crisis and go back to their original greatness. And this is now a time where many individuals like you acting together for a good plan can indeed change history. And the whole world is looking at us and you because the United States is the place which has the key to the future of destiny of mankind in its hand right now.
Mr. LaRouche, this is Luis Armendariz. I live here in Encina Heights, California. My background is in industrial engineering, and I'm also a part-time professor for Cal Poly Pomona here in California, and the School of Engineering. My comment here is about education. Since here in California and pretty much in all the United States, there has been a decline in agriculture as an overall industry. The second largest decline is gonna be in manufacturing, which also declining. So this opens what is called a big sector, what's called the service industry. So with this decline both in agriculture and manufacturing, this is going to put this country in dependency from other countries, such as China, such as South America, and Europe as well. So what this is going to happen is a trend in an impact in education as well. As you can see right now, with the manipulation of the media, the things that we eat, the things that we wear, the cars that we drive, is going to have an impact on dependency on education. The problem also, my question is around what your organization is doing around education. As we know here in California, there's a large proportion of teenagers that is about 20% between the ages of 15 to 18, that is about 20% that not in the school and doesn't have a job. So we actually seen a trend, very, very critical trend that the government is not doing enough to provide education all the way to superior level of education, such as university. There's been a struggle for students to find courses here just to go to college. So what is your organization doing around education?
Well, the problem here is not often the industries or the people who are applying for jobs in industry or wish they had jobs in industry or something of that nature. The problem is the culture of the United States is presently not actively doing anything about increasing employment or productivity. We're actually having a collapse, a real collapse of any possibility of creativity in productive employment in general. There are no jobs. No one is creating the jobs. And with what happened, just happened with the president's recent decision implemented, is now to starve people, to deny them jobs, give them sustenance employment, but not to give them the means to produce anything. We're killing. We are on the road of mass murder against our population. And it's going to hit the most probably the older people. It's going to hit the poorer people who are traditionally poorer. And there is little hope for the future of mankind as long as this is tolerated. We could, technically, the United States could, under the right president, and with the right policy, with the Glass-Steagall policy, the United States could organize growth in terms of improvement of the conditions and opportunities. And the opportunities is the real name. Because you know in production, in any all kinds of production, is the ability to rise from a less capability to rise to an improved one. And it's the process of progress from young people, young adults particularly, to go to older and to progress is the secret. We do not have any more a driver program for progress in the quality of employment or the results of it. Everything is being done to destroy people. And now what the president has just done is a death blow against progress. And the only solution for this thing is to get a real program going, as I indicated, which means you have to use a higher technology to get this thing moving. And then we got to realize that we are not doing anything to help most of our young people in finding a future for themselves. And I think the key thing is not the job, it's the future that counts. And the job is should be a part of an integral part of the future. If there's not improvement in skills, if there's not a challenge to do something better than you did before, you don't have real much in the way of progress. You have monotony, and that's terrible.
I just want to add, you know, that is why we emphasize so much that we need to go back to the Kennedy era paradigm, naturally applied for the present time, because if you remember during the Apollo program, if you would have asked pupils in the school, what do you want to become? There was a large number of people who said, I want to become an astronomer, an astronaut, I want to travel in space. There was a tremendous cultural optimism. And I think the equivalent of what Roosevelt did with the CCC program, you know, training untrained youth and putting them through education in a work job, it would be today, you know, both a Mars program to defend the planet against the danger of asteroids, the strategic defense of the Earth. But it would also be the idea, you know, that we develop a crash program for thermonuclear fusion so that young people would be motivated to again study natural science. And, you know, if you have a clear conception of where the world has to be in 10, 20, 50, 100 years from now, together with the kind of science driver program of NAVAPA, the World Land Bridge and so forth, you create an incentive, you know, because young people right now are really in a complete desperate mood. I mean, if you are a young person, with the present collapse in the transatlantic region, I mean, there is nothing to look forward to. And that has to be changed with a vision, and then people have to be mobilized around such a vision. And the CCC approach, you know, would be absolutely applicable in a modern form today.
Well, thank you both very much. That was an extraordinary dialogue. Let's just give both Helga and Lena a second round of appreciation.
Okay. Bye-bye.